Hello, and welcome to the first podcast for the RCGP Spotlight Project for Lyme Disease, delivered in conjunction with Lyme Disease Action and the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Educational Foundation. I'm Anne Cruikshank, a GP in Oxfordshire and clinical champion for the Spotlight Project, which is aimed at raising awareness amongst GPs and other primary care clinicians and supporting them in diagnosing and treating the condition. So today I'm talking about Lyme disease with Sandra Pearson, who's a consultant psychiatrist and is here from the National Charity and one of our funding partners, Lyme Disease Action. Hi, Sandra. Thank you so much for joining me today in the podcast. Can you please tell me about yourself and your interest in Lyme disease?
Well, thank you for inviting me, Anne. I'm a consultant psychiatrist and have personal experience of Lyme disease as a carer, and I've been medical director with Lyme Disease Action since 2011. Now, Lyme disease, also known as Lyme borreliosis, is a bacterial infection caused by Borrelia burgdorferi, which is a spirochete, and this may be transmitted to humans by the bite of an infected tick. It's an emerging zoonotic infection, so what this means is the main animal reservoir for the bacteria is actually in small rodents and ground-feeding birds, which the ticks feed on. Lyme disease can cause a wide range of symptoms, which can overlap with a wide variety of other conditions. But there are three key messages that I think we need to emphasise today, and these are tick awareness, the risk of Lyme disease, and the importance of early diagnosis and treatment in primary care. It's well recognised that early diagnosis and treatment provides the best chance of cure, whereas delayed diagnosis can result in slower recovery or persistent health problems for patients. There are a number of early signs, such as the bullseye rash, also called erythema migrans, which are important to recognise and diagnose. But other symptoms may be non-specific, may overlap with other conditions, and so can be easily missed. Primary care clinicians play a key role in preventing long-term complications. But unfortunately, early symptoms, if they are non-specific and if the rash doesn't appear, can be easily missed.
So perhaps we can start by discussing the ticks. I see you've actually brought some along with you today, and looking at them, it's amazing how small they are.
Well, yes, that's right, and most people are really surprised by this. The smaller ticks in this tube are nymphs, and this is an intermediate life stage, which is actually the one most likely to bite humans. And as you can see, they're only about the size of a poppy seed. And so this is one reason why tick bites can go unnoticed, especially if they crawl up behind the knee or in the groin area. Children as well may be bitten behind the hairline. So it's thought really only one in three people actually notice a tick bite. Ticks need to remain attached for up to 5 days to take a blood meal, and they secrete anti-inflammatory and anti-clotting agents in their saliva. So tick bites tend not to be itchy or painful either, unlike insect bites. Now, not all ticks carry Borrelia, so the risk of catching Lyme disease from a single tick bite in the UK is thought to be low. But of course, it may only take one tick bite to pass on the infection, particularly if an infected tick remains attached for long enough to become fully engorged with blood. The risk of disease transmission increases the longer an infected tick remains attached. So tick awareness, tick bite prevention, prompt tick removal is important. And we'll be including this in the forthcoming toolkit for the Spotlight Project.
Even if someone notices a tick bite, there's often confusion about how it should be removed. So what is the correct advice on removing ticks?
Well, ticks should be removed promptly but carefully with either a tick removal tool, such as a tick hook or a tick card, or else with very fine tooth tweezers, so not blunt eyebrow tweezers. And afterwards, the skin should be cleaned with antiseptic. Methods that traumatise the tick, such as crushing, burning or smothering the tick in petroleum jelly or nail polish, well, these should be avoided because these can cause the tick to regurgitate its infected stomach contents into the bite wound.
And just how common is Lyme disease?
Well, as far as we know, Lyme disease probably isn't common in the UK, but the incidence is definitely increasing. The official figures recorded by Public Health England show that the incidence has been steadily increasing in the UK since reporting began in the 1980s. It's important to remember that official figures represent laboratory confirmed cases, so they underestimate the true scale of the problem. So in 2017, there were just over 1,500 lab-confirmed cases in England and Wales. But of course, these figures don't include cases that are diagnosed clinically or any cases that may be missed. So this is a genuine area of uncertainty, and the true estimate may be 3 times or maybe 20 times the lab confirmed rate. Most cases occur in southern counties of the UK, even in central London and the Scottish Highlands. Most cases will present in June when ticks are more active, with a smaller peak in September. In the UK, older people in the 45 to 60 year old age group seem to have a slight increased risk. An important research recommendation from NICE was the need for more robust epidemiological data in the UK.
So why is the incidence of Lyme disease increasing? Is it a genuine increase?
Well, Lyme disease is now the most common vector-borne disease in the Northern Hemisphere. And although some of the observed increase in incidence may be due to increased awareness, climate change, changes in land management, biodiversity and human behaviour, they're all thought to be relevant. And ticks are gradually expanding their territory into new areas. Deer and larger mammals don't carry Lyme disease itself, but play a role in tick feeding, tick mating and tick dispersal. They have natural immunity to the bacteria Borrelia. And it's mice and small rodents which form the reservoir for Borrelia in nature. And it's because of this animal reservoir, that's why it isn't possible to, say, eradicate Lyme disease from an area unlike malaria.
So faced with the fact that the tick bites might go unnoticed and that symptoms really are non-specific in many cases, diagnosing Lyme disease can present quite a challenge for primary care clinicians.
Well, yes, this seems to be the feedback from patients who contact Lyme Disease Action, who sometimes can be unwell for many years before being diagnosed, and also from GPs and healthcare professionals who I speak to at exhibitions and conferences. We have contact with GPs who are certainly seeking clinical advice on how to deal with Lyme disease, how to recognise it and treat it in a primary care setting. And so I'd like to hear some more from you and from a GP perspective. What advice should be given by a GP to a patient who's had a tick bite?
Well, I think when patients present in the surgery with a tick attached, or a history of having a tick removed, then it's important that this is recorded in the notes. And any ticks attached at that time should be removed carefully by clinical staff, just as you've described. If the patient's really completely well at that point, then they can really be reassured that prophylactic antibiotics aren't necessary. But they do need to be advised to watch out for the development of a bullseye rash or any flu-like symptoms over the following weeks and months, and definitely return if they develop any such symptoms.
Would you like to say more about the symptoms of early Lyme disease?
Well, obviously there's the bullseye rash, as we've mentioned, also known as erythema migrans, and it is diagnostic of Lyme if it's present and needs to be treated with antibiotics as per the NICE guidelines. And a blood test isn't required at that point. But unfortunately, about 30% of Lyme disease patients probably don't recall a bullseye rash, which makes diagnosis much more difficult. A typical rash probably appears about 2 to 30 days after the tick bite. And it can be between 5 and 20 centimetres in diameter, but not necessarily at the site of the bite. And whilst there may be an obvious bullseye appearance, more often it could just be an irregularly shaped red patch, which is not usually itchy or painful. So the diagnosis isn't easy, and the rashes can often be misdiagnosed as ringworm or cellulitis or an allergic reaction to an insect bite. The other key feature really is flu symptoms out of season. And this is where the difficulty lies. Lyme disease patients may just appear with mild or severe flu-like symptoms such as fever or sweats or swollen lymph nodes or fatigue, neck pain, migratory muscle pain or joint pain. They often describe brain fog where they really can't concentrate. They may have headaches or nerve pain or numbness or all sorts of unusual symptoms that can come and go. Standard blood tests usually are normal at this point. If the patient's already reported a tick bite, then the diagnosis might be clearer. But often, If a patient is presenting with flu-like symptoms out of season, then the clinician needs to have that in their differential diagnosis and to ask about potential tick exposure, recent travel, or whether there have been any recent tick bites. If the diagnosis really still isn't clear, then it would definitely be important to review the patient, as the flu-like symptoms that tend to develop just may be quite atypical and persistent. And Lyme serology might help to confirm the diagnosis, but as we've mentioned before, a negative test doesn't exclude it. The NICE guideline definitely recommends starting treatment based on clinical suspicion rather than allowing for a delay whilst waiting for test results. And the clinical response to the antibiotics themselves may actually help the diagnosis. And though patients should be warned, they might actually experience a slight worsening of symptoms during the first 5 days. If patients remain unwell despite antibiotics for a three-week course, then definitely a further course of antibiotics should be considered.
And what other symptoms should GPs look out for that can be caused by Lyme disease?
Well, this again is another difficulty. If the infection spreads through the body, then patients may present with symptoms affecting any system within the body, such as facial palsy, chest pain, shortness of breath, headache, anxiety, fatigue, poor concentration, unusual neurological symptoms, even meningitis or encephalitis. I think it's probably not realised necessarily that in Europe, neurological problems tend to be much more common than in the USA, where Lyme arthritis is a more common presentation. If these symptoms are severe, then the patients are likely to be admitted to hospital and hopefully diagnosed quickly and may even need IV antibiotics. But the less severe intermittent multi-systemic symptoms can present so much more of a challenge to the GP, and they might be coming going over months or even years. It's also important to remember that symptoms such as anxiety are often a feature of the disease rather than a reaction to it.
So can you tell us some more about the treatment for Lyme disease?
Well, there's no internationally recognised treatment protocol for Lyme, and many countries and different organisations have developed their own guidelines. The recent NICE guideline has produced recommendations based on a patient's age and severity of symptoms, and in most cases, 3 weeks of oral doxycycline or amoxicillin is recommended as the first-line treatment, while azithromycin is an alternative. Some non-UK guidelines, on the other hand, suggest a 2 to 4 week course of antibiotics, whilst others even suggest treating until all symptoms have completely resolved.
And do all patients recover with 3 to 6 weeks of antibiotics?
Well, yes, most patients probably do, if they're treated early. But unfortunately, an unknown number of patients probably have persistent symptoms. And certainly patients who are diagnosed later in the disease are less likely to make a full recovery with this treatment option. The only other thing to be aware of, obviously, with patients with ongoing symptoms is it's important to confirm that they did comply with the medication regime and also to consider the possibility of an alternative diagnosis.
So for patients with ongoing symptoms, what are their alternatives? What should a GP say?
This is one of the key uncertainties around Lyme. It's unclear as to whether the ongoing symptoms are due to ongoing infection or inflammation or an autoimmune response or even a combination of all three. And there is research evidence showing that spirochetes can survive prolonged courses of antibiotics. And there are many physicians and patients who've reported benefit from prolonged treatment regimes. But many authorities dispute this and describe the condition as post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. And unfortunately, the NICE guideline committee felt that there was insufficient evidence to make a recommendation on this matter, and they really have advised that we need more research. The other thing to note is that at the present time, there are no specialist Lyme disease clinics in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult situation. So how should a GP manage patients with ongoing symptoms after treatment for Lyme disease?
I think it really is important for GPs to be aware that patients really can experience significant long-term symptoms and that these are genuine symptoms which may affect work or education. And they may require treatment for those individual symptoms via different specialists, but they may also require access to support to access social services and educational support.
So how would you summarise the advice for GPs then?
I think the key is that Lyme disease really is a complex disease, which has been aptly described as the new great imitator, and that diagnosis and prompt treatment in line with the NICE guideline does significantly increase the likelihood of successful treatment. And the diagnosis may have to be made on clinical grounds, since, as we keep saying, a negative test doesn't exclude the diagnosis. I think the main point is having a high index of suspicion and raising awareness amongst all members of the primary care team should definitely produce significant benefits for patients and staff.
There are educational resources around available for clinicians and patients. Would you like to tell us what's available for GPs?
Well, the RCGP Spotlight Project is developing an online toolkit which will provide information on prevention and diagnosis and treatment. And it will also include a link to the RCGP e-learning module, which is freely available to all GPs. There'll also be free workshops on Lyme disease for GPs. And several of the UK charities do produce leaflets and can provide health information, health promotion material, which can be displayed in the practice waiting room.
Well, hopefully the Spotlight Project for Lyme disease will provide a key opportunity to help raise that awareness and improve recognition of Lyme disease in primary care. Lyme Disease Action is really looking forward to working with the Royal College of General Practitioners to help develop and deliver this important project further.
Thanks, Sandra. And the College is really grateful for the support that Lyme disease and ILADEF are giving to this project. Thank you again for joining me today in the podcast and for sharing your insights. And thank you for listening. We hope that you've found this podcast useful, and you can find further information in the eLyme Disease Toolkit, which will soon be available on the RCGP website and will continue to grow as the Spotlight Project develops.